Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Moeller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Moeller Program. Can you imagine what it must feel like today in the nation of Iraq to know that they have now held a successful election? I wonder where the naysayers are going now. All those who said it couldn't happen, all those who are saying, look, this election isn't going to mean anything, no one's going to turn out, the threat of violence is going to be too high. Where are all those now admitting they were wrong, who said the elections needed to be postponed or wouldn't be held or couldn't be credible? Yesterday was a great day, not only for the people of Iraq, but for the people of the world, because this is a chink in the armor. This is the first crack in the glacier. This is the first thaw in the autocracy of the Muslim world. The Arab world has never seen an election like this before, and it would not have happened had it not been for the American invasion and for the removal of Saddam Hussein. Let's listen to President George W. Bush, who spoke yesterday about the success of the Iraqi elections.
Today, the people of Iraq have spoken to the world, and the world is hearing the voice of freedom from the center of the Middle East.
Yeah, the president and I were reading the same news reports because there was one particular voter whose testimony really spoke to me, a man who lost a leg in an attack and said he would have crawled to get there. Let's listen to the president talking about this. You can hear the passion in his voice talking about this one who so bravely went to the place to vote.
One news account told of a voter who had lost a leg in a terror attack last year and went to the polls today despite threats of violence. He said, I would have crawled here if I had to. I don't want terrorists to kill other Iraqis like they tried to kill me. Today, I am voting for peace.
Well, and he did. He did vote for peace, and what a powerful statement that was, very profound statement, having to do with the fact that there was a price that had been paid for his right to vote, and it was a price that he did not want to be paid in vain. British Prime Minister Tony Blair also had a statement to make, and as always, he got right to the point.
It may have been the force of arms that removed Saddam and created circumstances in which Iraqis could vote. But it was the force of freedom that was felt throughout Iraq today.
The British Prime Minister spoke, and of course, in the aftermath of all this, you also have to wonder, where are those who said it couldn't happen? And I would just be relieved if even one of them would come forth and say, hey, I was wrong. I didn't think that upwards of 60% of the Iraqi people would vote. And that's not what you heard. As a matter of fact, yesterday morning on the Talking Head shows, you heard people from both parties battering this back and forth. And, of course, one of the persons that was quite, I guess, naturally and to be expected called upon to comment was Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Let's listen to what he had to say.
It is significant that there is a vote in Iraq. But no one in the United States or in the world, and I'm confident of what the world response will be, no one in the United States should try to overhype this election. This election is a sort of demarcation point. And what really counts now is the effort to have a legitimate political reconciliation. And it's going to take a massive diplomatic effort and a much more significant outreach to the international community than this administration has been willing to engage in. Absent that, we will not be successful in Iraq.
Absent that, we will not be successful in Iraq. Now, folks, that to me is a pitiable response. Let me tell you what Senator Kerry could have said yesterday. Senator Kerry should have said yesterday, this is a true test for the Iraqi people. We're going to find out where they are. But let's hope the Iraqi people are up to this. Let's hope they will stare down those who are threatening terrorism. Let's hope they will not be deterred by violence. And let's hope this is the start of a grand new renaissance for freedom in the Middle East. That's what he could have said. That's what he should have said. Because what this amounts to, folks, is the fact that there are people in our own domestic sphere who wish for George W. Bush to be branded a failure because of Iraq. And, you know, that's bad enough. But what this means is that they are willing for the Iraqis to pay the price for their political agenda. And there is no excuse for that. Where is the morality of the French and the Germans and those on the left of the British system and those who are the liberals in the American system who want this to be a failure? And I'm sorry, but you really can't put it any other way. Just look at how some of the news coverage has taken this. Ted Koppel saying, how much is going to have to be the turnout in this vote before it's considered a legitimate election? 60%, 70%, 80%? Well, Mr. Koppel, have you noticed the turnout in the American elections of recent years? If it was barely over 60%, as some are now saying in Iraq, that is roughly the same as the 2004 presidential election in the United States of America, which was the highest turnout since 1968. So is Mr. Koppel now insinuating that every election from 1968 until the present was illegitimate? You know, what we face here is the reality that a lot of people just, I think, lack a common faith, just a very basic faith, that peoples of the world can learn to exercise freedom and to participate in a democratic context. There has been so much said. There have been so many articles published on this, but one caught my heart in particular. It's by Bakhtiar Dargali, published in the Wall Street Journal. It is entitled The Long Road to a Vote. Excuse me, it's in the New York Times, this particular article. This man wrote from Plano, Texas. Listen to this. In 1976, when I was 15, my older brother and I left behind our parents, four brothers, three sisters, 500 cousins, and our beloved village of Dargala in the Kurdish part of Iraq to come to the United States. We also left behind many bad memories of hiding out in freezing caves in the mountains to escape the Ba'athists, as Saddam's parties, bombardment of the Kurds, of seeing our uncle's family blown up by government planes. What we didn't have was any memories of seeing anyone in our family vote. Let me read that sentence again. What we didn't have was any memories of seeing anyone in our family vote. Saddam Hussein's candidates always won 100% of the vote, but the election booths in our section of Iraq were in the form of mass graves. There was no indelible ink to prevent fraud in elections, only the indelible pain of broken dreams and the loss of loved ones since our part of Kurdistan was annexed to Iraq in the 1920s. When I voted in this country for the first time, I thought how lucky Americans were. A vote is taken for granted here, while back in Iraq, people died and are dying now for it. I voted in every election here since. And on Sunday, my large family in Iraq will all vote for my 72-year-old father and my 70-year-old mother. It will be their first time. My mother told me that she would brave the current blizzard in the mountains of Kurdistan to go vote, even though she is very ill. My father, a Kurdish freedom fighter for two decades, looks forward to voting as eagerly as a child awaiting to open his Christmas gifts. They do not want America to fail in its effort to bring democracy to Iraq. After all, they and the 7 million other Kurds want to cast a vote for a new Iraq that will be based on the principles of freedom, federalism, and the recognition that any union between the Arab majority and the Kurdish minority is voluntary. Now listen to these words very seriously. I think this is just about as powerful as any testimony can come. Nevertheless, he says, when I heard about the plans for Iraqis in the United States to vote in the national elections, my initial reaction was not to participate. Although I feel a strong tie to my homeland, I am an American citizen, and my life is here now. But then came the news that 31 Marines died on Wednesday in western Iraq when their helicopter crashed as they were on what General John Abazayad said was a mission in support of the election. How can I ignore the sacrifice of those Marines who died so my family can vote? The best way for me to honor their martyrdom is to vote myself. That means that my wife, Alea, and I are driving to Nashville. That's one of the five cities in the United States where Iraqi expatriates could vote, by the way. Coming along with us will be our 7-year-old daughter, Connie. She will get to see something I never got to see as a child, her parents voting for freedom in an Iraqi election. I got to tell you, I got teary-eyed when I read that article the first time. And I had an emotional response when I read that article the second time. You know, what would it have been like if at the time of the American Revolution, some of the people in this country got to write about what it was like to vote for the first time? What would it be like if we could go back and see the kind of testimonies that emerged out of that liberation? What if we saw the testimonies of the people in Japan who, after World War II, when their country was reconstituted, said, I had the first opportunity to vote? Or in India, after its independence in the late 1940s, where their people had the first time to vote? We are seeing democracy being aborned here. We're seeing the birth of a new wave of freedom. And even if there are pitfalls along the way, and there will be, if there are landmines in the road, and there certainly are obstacles in the way, this still will go down as a milestone in America's witness to the world. It will go down as a milestone in the history of the Iraqi people, and it will go down as a milestone on the road to freedom. I really appreciate those who have been putting it in a global context. Just 70 years ago, only a small part of the world was ruled by democratic governments. At the end of the 20th century, you can make a plausible argument that almost half of the world was ruled by democratic governments. How long will it be before we can say that almost all of the world is ruled by democratic governments? I think the March of Freedom is going to be hard to thwart and even more difficult to push back. And I would say to those in Washington and in Western Europe who are on the wrong side of this question of history, you better get on the right side before the history books are written. We're going to be back today to talk about a controversy involving President George W. Bush and statements he made about adoption. In particular, answering the question posed by the editors of the New York Times, should homosexual couples be able to adopt? The president gave a statement that I found absolutely amazing. I think you will too. I'm Albert Mohler, and I'll be right back. Well, it all came in the context of an interview that President Bush gave to the editors of the New York Times. Not necessarily the friendliest audience for the president here. After all, the New York Times endorsed his opponent, Senator John Kerry, and it's taken a very hard and critical line against the administration. The New York Times published a partial transcript of the interview it had with the president, and buried right in the middle of it was an amazing exchange. I talked about this just briefly in the program on Friday, but I'm going to return to it today as our main topic because the more I look at it, the more I think these may be among some of the most important words that President George W. Bush has yet spoken while in office. Listen to this. President Bush was asked, on the Florida law that bars gay men and women from adopting children, he said, in response to the question, the ideal of society is to raise children with a man and a woman. Private adoption firms can make whatever choice they choose to do, but as president, I will always be aiming for the ideal. I don't know this particular case. I just gave you my general principles. I just said the ideal is where a man and a woman... That is where a child being raised by a man and a woman, that's the ideal, a married man and a woman. And as governor and as president, when I was governor of Texas, my position was that this is the ideal. I believe children can receive love from gay couples, but the ideal is, and studies have shown that the ideal is, where a child is raised in a married family with a man and a woman. Now, you'll forgive the president there because this was an oral response to a question, came in a conversation. So that middle paragraph has some convoluted clauses in it. But what he says is that the ideal is where a child is being raised by a man and a woman. And then he went on to say, who are married to each other. Now, when I first saw that statement, I thought, well, way to go, Mr. President. I mean, that is nothing more than stellar 14-karat bravery right there. Because when the editors of the New York Times ask about this, you don't have to wonder where they're coming from. They have editorialized in favor of gay adoption. They have editorialized in favor of gay marriage. They have editorialized in favor of normalizing everything related to sexuality and homosexuality. And I got to give this president his due. And I want to tell you something else. I was actually surprised at how clear the president was on this, because I can guarantee you there were some political advisors who were sweating bullets when they heard the president go into this territory. Because the conventional wisdom is that presidents or politicians in general ought to steer towards generalized statements that won't offend anyone. And let me tell you, this statement is going to offend a lot of people. It's going to offend those who think that it really doesn't matter whether a child is parented by a same-sex couple, a married heterosexual couple, a single person, or you name it, whatever kind of inventive family structure someone might want to put together. Now, this was published in Friday's edition of the New York Times, Friday, January 28, 2005. Still available on the Internet. You can go to it and read it yourself. And as you might imagine, there was an answer, and you didn't have to wait long. It was the next morning. In the next morning's New York Times, there's an article with a headline, Experts Dispute Bush on Gay Adoption Issue. Now, let's put a little footnote in right now. Number one, who are these experts, and who gets to decide who's an expert? Folks, you can ask me all the questions you want on Ask Anything Wednesday about sports. And I will give you everything I know, which is so very little that I would have to act like I know more than I know. And I don't want to do that. And that's why I don't have a sports show. I'm not offended by sports. I'm just not all that interested in all that goes on. I don't understand why so many people spend so much time watching people do something they can't do anything about. And then I don't understand people who get so excited when things go well and so depressed when things go wrong, when nothing in the whole world is changed by whether or not your team wins or loses. How's that for a setup for the Super Bowl? So I am not an expert on sports, and you need to know that. But you know what? The New York Times could call me an expert on sports so long as I say what they want to hear. They could call me, and if I tell them what they want to hear, guess what? I am now an expert on sports. And that's exactly what happened in the response to the president's statements on adoption. They went to people, and guess what? They're now experts. They can now put on their resume, called an expert by the New York Times. How do you become an expert on this? Let me tell you who the experts would be. The experts would be the people who could look at this with a very clear moral understanding and a very clear sociological understanding and look at this and ask all the right questions, come up with the right answers, and bring it back. And that's going to take a lot of time because that's going to have to be an intergenerational study. We're not going to know the wreckage from a lot of our cultural and moral decisions right now. It's going to take a long time for the cultural toll, the individual and personal toll to show. But listen to this. Here's how Benedict Carey's article began in Saturday's New York Times. Are children worse off being raised by gay or lesbian couples than by heterosexual parents? Responding on Thursday to a question about gay adoption, President Bush suggested that they were. But experts say there's no scientific evidence that children raised by gay couples do any worse socially, academically, or emotionally than their peers raised in more traditional households. The experts who cross the political spectrum, by the way, that's from left to far left, say studies have shown that, on average, children raised by two married heterosexual parents fare better on a number of measures, including school performance, than those raised by single parents or by parents who are living together but unmarried. Now, did you hear that? What they're saying here is that it just matters whether people are married, not whether it's a same-sex couple or a heterosexual couple. Now, listen to this. But, said Dr. Judith Stacy, a professor of sociology at New York University, there is not a single legitimate scholar out there who argues that growing up with gay parents is somehow bad for children. Now, there are whoppers, and there are whoppers, and this is the whopper of whoppers. Number one, expert Judith Stacy. Who is she? Well, she is the author of a series of books that argues that the family needs to be delegitimated and denormalized, period. So we're not talking about someone here, some dispassionate scholar, who's sitting in some ivory tower context looking at objective data. We're looking at a feminist who is very much involved in believing that the family is a patriarchal and oppressive institution that needs to be deconstructed. No better way to deconstruct it than by normalizing same-sex marriage and then same-sex adoption. She says here, there is not a single legitimate scholar out there who argues that growing up with gay parents is somehow bad for children. Not one, she says. Not one that's legitimate. Legitimate in whose eyes? Well, the eyes of the expert Dr. Judith Stacy, of course. And now, of course, also the expert who decides who's the expert on the editorial process of the New York Times. You knew this had to come. This was inevitable. As soon as the president made these brave statements, you had to know that an entire parade of experts was going to be brought out by the New York Times. There's more in here, of course. Since 1980, researchers have published about 25 studies comparing children from same-sex households with peers and traditional families using measures of social adjustment, school performance, mental health, and emotional resilience. Some of the studies have focused on elementary school children, others on those not quite teenagers, a few on adolescents, a handful of followed children for the years. Uniformly, the authors have reported there are no significant developmental differences between the two groups of children. You look at that and you think, well, maybe that ought to be informative. Maybe we ought to take that seriously, until you realize that there are so few of these families to be studied that it is nearly a statistically insignificant sampling in the first place. This isn't science. This is ideology. But, of course, in the New York Times, this is just the experts speaking. The experts responding to the president, who, of course, is only president of the United States. What does he know? Let's bring out the experts. Dr. Judith Stacy also said that children in same-sex families tend to be more communicative with their parents. Now, where's the data for that? What does that mean? And why does it matter? And number one, is the New York Times now saying that children would be better off parented by same-sex couples? Well, that's the implication of this article. I want to know what you think. I mean, this is one of those dividing line issues. Either you believe that it really does or it really doesn't make a difference whether children are adopted by same-sex couples. I want to know what you think of President Bush's statement. Some of you may disagree with him. Others may be, frankly, just pleased and surprised that a sitting president of the United States would have such moral courage to answer a question this way. Either way, I'd love to hear from you. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. President George W. Bush gave his honest answer to the editors of the New York Times, and my guess is it surprised them. Well, surprise us by your conversation and what you think about this. 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We've been talking about President Bush's statements to the editors of the New York Times related to the fact that the ideal family for an adoption would be a married couple, a heterosexual married couple, and he spoke very clearly to this. And, of course, the question did not come out of a vacuum. It came out of the fact that just days ago, the United States Supreme Court refused to take a case on appeal from some plaintiffs from Florida who were suing to force the state of Florida to allow gay adoptions. The state of Florida right now is the only state with a blanket law prohibiting homosexuals from adopting children. And, of course, this question addressed to the president had a particular angle on it because the governor of Florida is the president's brother. That's Governor Jeb Bush. And so this was an issue that the editors of the New York Times must have been salivating to hear the president squirm about, but he didn't squirm. He just answered calmly and very clearly, and in a way that that I thought was both appropriate and profound, and contextualized in just the right way, too, because he spoke about what he would, as president, seek to do, and that is to point to the ideal. That's an acknowledgement that there are a lot of sub-ideal situations, but he would speak to the ideal, and I thought he did so very, very powerfully. Let's go to Dora, calling from the Bronx in New York, listening on XM Satellite. Dora, glad to hear from you from New York. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'm in accordance. The ideal is a couple, but we have to think about the children also. Instead of being raised in an orphanage or in a group home or in a hospital, you know, if a couple want to give love or a single parent want to give love to that child and adopt that child and take him out of that situation, then that's okay also. You know, we have to stop thinking about all the grown-ups and the laws and everything. If somebody, when a person want to give love to that child and raise him with love and, you know, with all the good stuff, then that's the idea for that child.
Well, Dora, I appreciate your point of concern for the child. And I guess that that just leads me to ask over the long term how we really measure, you know, what is best for the child. And obviously, an abandoned child needs help. And we should be thankful when that child gets help from whatever source. But as a society, we have to put together laws and policies and procedures that that formalize something like an adoption process. And I think that's where I've got to argue with you here. I think we as a society have to be very careful about what we normalize in terms of our adoption laws and our marriage laws. And for that reason, I would argue that it is also concern for the child that would lead to that. Dora, very, very, very thoughtful point. It'll be interesting to see how other callers might respond to you. We appreciate you calling from the Bronx. Great to hear from you there in New York. Let's go to Ken calling from Cleveland, Ohio, listening on WHK. Ken, go right ahead. We lost Ken. Let's go to Carolyn driving through Oklahoma. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Good morning. I agree with President Bush. I am a Christian. I have a sister who is a homosexual, and I would not want her to raise my children if they were not already grown. Their values are different than ours, and that's going to instill those same values in the children.
Carolyn, let me come back at you and ask you a question. Now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want to ask you. Now, you would say that you both love your children and you love your sister, but that doesn't mean I'm going to assume that you believe your sister and her lifestyle would be best suited to raise your children. Is that right?
They are not. I would not want her to raise my children, and I do love my sister, and I would do anything I could for her, but I don't believe that her lifestyle is a way that children should be raised.
Well, Carolyn, I appreciate your call, and good to hear from Oklahoma there. Folks, there's still an opportunity for you to call. Let me just get the number out there real quick. It's 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We've heard from Dora and from Carolyn, two different positions. And as a matter of fact, two radically different positions. Dora says it's about the kids, and if the kids are cared for and are loved by a same-sex couple, then it shouldn't matter. Society should simply just allow persons, she said even single persons, to adopt if that means the child is going to be loved. Carolyn said, speaking as having a homosexual sister, that she's not going to buy that. She's not going along with it. Where do you come down on this? And this isn't some kind of hypothetical question. This is a real-life question. According to the Family Research Council, there are several states that openly permit gay adoption. Those states are California, Connecticut, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey. And that is also Vermont and the District of Columbia. But there are some situations with the California profile and procedures that may complicate that a little bit, but otherwise it's still obviously happening that homosexual couples are adopting in California. Want to know what you think from wherever you live? Give us a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. America has been served by a lot of politicians, or should I say misserved, who will not say what they think. They are so scripted, so protected, so encapsulated in a cocoon of public relations, you never really know what they think because their advisors never let them say anything. It's a breath of fresh air when a president of the United States looks right at the editorial board of the New York Times and says the ideal is for a child to be adopted by a man and a woman who are married to each other. And it's even odder that that's revolutionary in newsmaking in the year 2005. But that's reality. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to a lively discussion on President Bush's comments related to same-sex adoption, that is, the adoption of children by homosexual couples. It got a lot of attention. Not only was it featured in the interview the New York Times published on Friday, but they responded with a piece citing experts that they put together to tell us all why the president is wrong. If you want to read some experts on the other side, by the way, you can go to the website for the Family Research Council. That's FRC.org, FRC.org, and you can find some contrary data there from the Family Research Council and its research staff. But let's just go to the callers now. We have a lively discussion going here. If you want to join it, the number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Ken calling from Cleveland, Ohio, listening on WHK. Ken, go right ahead.
Hi. I definitely agree with the president. But here's a thought that I've been entertaining in listening to all this talk about homosexuality. Let's just pretend that it's okay. And let's pretend that it's okay to the point where everybody becomes a homosexual. Now, how can somebody believe that something that could potentially wipe out the human race be okay? Because the last I heard, Men can't have babies together, and women can't have babies together. So if everybody became a homosexual, how long would it take before the human race would be completely wiped out?
Yeah, thanks for your call, Ken. And by the way, I think you got the latest update on that. I think that situation's still pretty much the same, that procreation takes a man and a woman. And Ken, there's a basic moral principle at stake in what you're arguing here. And that is this. When a couple that is not a male and a female attempts to have a baby, they have to do it by some other means. And these are pretty graphic. I mean, for lesbian couples, you've got to have artificial insemination, if not some kind of IVF or adoption. And, of course, for male homosexuals, there's no opportunity for artificial insemination to do anything. Because I tell you, there's one thing a man certainly can't do, and that's carry a baby to term. And so adoption is the only route there. And I guess there could be some kind of surrogacy with the contribution of one of the male partners. But nonetheless, some kind of adoption is what's going to be necessary. And, you know, again, our bodies testify to us. The structure of the human race is a testimony of God's design. And that's why in the Bible, homosexual acts are referred to as against nature. Because God has made us with a nature as a man and a nature as woman that is inclined to each other, directed to each other. Complementary is the relationship between the man and the woman, designed for each other, for God's glory. Good point, Ken. Let's go to Jackie calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Jackie, go right ahead.
Hello, Dr. Mueller. I'm not sure I'm exactly an expert, but I am adopted. And I would like to just point out one thing that maybe people who are not adopted may not consider. And that is, when you're adopted, you're different. All your life, you know you're different, that you were adopted into a family. You don't belong, and that's a basic part of a human need, is to belong. I got the question all through my growing up, what does it feel like to be adopted? I can't imagine if I was to get a double whammy and be asked the question, what does it feel like to be adopted, and what does it feel like to have two mothers or two fathers? I was adopted into a traditional, wonderful home. God took good care of me. But I had troubles anyway. I just can't imagine. I just can't imagine.
Jackie, that is such a sweet testimony. I mean, that is a wonderful contribution for you to bring here. And I have to tell you that I don't know what the New York Times would say about you, but I'm going to give you the label of expert, because I think you're speaking from firsthand experience from what it was like to be an adopted child. And I appreciate several things of what you had to say, Jackie. First of all, I appreciate how you speak so powerfully, the fact that God took care of you and that you were adopted by a wonderful married couple. And how you still, nonetheless, as a child, had to face questions. And I think you're exactly right. Just how different can it be forced upon a child to have to speak to a same-sex parent? And, of course, you find indoctrination now going on in the schools. You find that the books, you know, Heather Has Two Mommies, very famous now, over a decade old. And, there are others, Daddy's Roommate, written by the same author and by the same publishing company, just trying to normalize this, even in terms of pictures and text and all the rest for young children. Jackie, that was a powerful word. I appreciate your call. Let's go to Dan calling from Panama City, Florida, listening on XM Satellite. Dan, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm an adoptive father myself, and my wife, we're both Christians. We're actually in the middle of another adoption, our third adoption for twins from Guatemala. And I think that just the fact that there are Christians that are confused about this lets us know that from our pulpit, we aren't talking nearly enough about adoption and about the important role that Christian couples play in the lives of these children.
Dan, that's another very important word we need to hear, and I think you're exactly right. You know, because in the Bible, we have a theology of adoption. As a matter of fact, one of the metaphors for our salvation found in the New Testament is that we are adopted as sons and daughters of the Most High. And so we have a picture of our salvation being adoption. It ought to be very much central and understood and appreciated and promoted among Christians that we would talk about adopting children who so desperately need to be cared for and loved and brought into the family. And so, Dan, thanks for that call. I'm not sure that point would have been made if you had not called. And it's wonderful to hear from an adoptive parent. And I can tell you on this campus, by the way, at Southern Seminary and Boyce College, one of the amazing things is even on our faculty and around the whole culture of the institution, there are many families who have adopted. That's also true in the church that I and my family attend. And that's a wonderful thing. And you remind us we need to talk about it. We need to talk about not only the fact that it is and not only that it's heartwarming, but that we as Christians have a special understanding of this as well. All right, Dan, thanks. We're going to go very quickly to Ron with seconds just before we go into the break, calling from Live Oak, Florida. Ron, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Muller. What does God have to say about the sins of the father being handed down in like an example by the parents to the children?
Well, Ron, I'd have to say this. If you have homosexual adoption normalized across the country, that basically normalizes homosexuality in a very real sense. And so that can't, I would say, but break down moral barriers and social barriers to the acceptance of homosexuality. Now, I know there are all kinds of social scientists who come in and argue this issue both ways, saying that sons raised in same-sex parents don't necessarily turn out to be more homosexual than sons raised in heterosexual families and all the rest. Well, number one, we don't know long-term what this is going to look like. But number two, we also don't know what influence this is going to have on the society as we have this kind of amorphous sexuality, whether it's homosexuality or whatever, bisexuality, transgendered parents and all the rest. America has just decided, or at least the elites in this society have decided, that we're going to go into a great, long, open-ended experiment. And I just don't think it's good, to say the very least, that children become the pawns in these social experiments. We've had a good discussion. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Been tracking the pornography issue in America because any way you look at it, it's one of the most insidious assaults upon the family and human dignity and the integrity of human sexuality. And the light seems to go on for different people in different ways at different times. And I'll tell you, the light went on for one British couple just over the last several days. According to today's edition of the Daily Mirror, a devout Baptist couple in Somerset, that's in England, couldn't believe their eyes when their Doris Day family film turned out to be a porn flick. So, as the paper says, they watched the whole movie to make sure they saw what they were seeing before they complained. Listen to this. Evidently, the couple bought a cheap CD, that is a DVD movie. They paid £2.99, and they thought they were getting a Doris Day movie. The older man, the husband in this couple, said, quote, "We knew something was amiss when a warning flashed up on the screen advising under 18s not to carry on watching." He went on and said, "It was a pretty raunchy, explicit film. It certainly pulled no punches. My wife and I were very shocked, but we watched it until the end because we couldn't believe what we were seeing." They had expected to see the harmless story of a bunch of women workers in a pajama factory, but as the man said, naked women appeared and started talking in Italian. We were horrified. Well, this Baptist couple, bless their heart, I guess, they had to watch it to the end expecting Doris Day to show up for their family flick. But, folks, you shouldn't have to watch it to the end to figure out what you're seeing. The issue of pornography is an insidious assault, and it is the topic of my commentary today at crosswalk.com. You can go to Albert Moeller, that's MOHLER.com, or to crosswalk.com, look under the weblogs, and you will find what I think is a pretty important expose of just how pervasive the pornography problem is in America. One of the things I mentioned in this article is that some hotel chains are now telling us that one out of every two of their customers purchases some form of pornography, including videos used in hotel rooms, pay-per-view flicks shown in hotel rooms. That tells you something of where we stand as a nation. It tells you also something of what we're up against in terms of tackling the problem of pornography, because even though in years past it may have been a problem that was very concentrated among a few, now it is widely spread among many. One of the most pervasive moral plagues in America today. And, of course, all you have to know is that there are hundreds of these porn flicks that are released every single month, and that some now estimate it is, if you put it all together, one of the biggest industries in America. Some rank it as the seventh largest industry in America. We are a nation, it turns out, with an insatiable appetite for pornography. The big question now is, what's the antidote to this? It can only be the truth. And it can only be the transforming truth of the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. We're here to speak the truth. We're here to show the light in the midst of darkness. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about former, that is to say retired, Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Spong. He's down in Florida today, and he's up to no good, and we'll tell you why. See you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.